بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم إن الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله. Brothers and sisters and friends, thank you for having me. I greet you with the warmest Islamic greetings of peace. May God's peace be with you all. If only my wife was listening to that introduction, maybe someone could send me the recording. Now, leadership in a lost world is a very important topic. And one of the main reasons that I got involved with Medology is because I met Brother Amin and I just saw the sincerity in his face. And I saw that he wanted to touch, move, and inspire people and build an empire for the sake of God, not for the sake of his ego or for the sake of status or wealth. Now you may argue, Hamza, how do you recognize people in that way? Well, it's a hunch, and I think we all have it, right? If you read the book Blink, there's an interesting chapter towards the end that talks about just reading faces. It's called physiognomy, right? It's like the study of physiology, gaining knowledge of someone through their facial expressions. In actual fact, two key psychologists studied every single muscle in the face, and they correlated subtleties and slight movements and shapes and facial expressions, even for a split moment, to certain personality traits. And I think one of them had like a 95% accuracy rate. I'm not saying I have that ability, but I have seen that in the brother, and I was really touched, moved, and inspired, because we don't see this anymore. We don't see true leadership. Like, frankly, let's be honest. Let's just, you know, a spade is a spade, right? We just care about ourselves. We have this individualistic, narcissistic perspective of ourselves and our lives. We project onto the world and we forget the world. And it's just us. In actual fact, we think we are the world. And because of the crisis of modernity, it's really played with our ego, especially social media, right? It's all about me, my likes, my shares, my selfies, the empty face that is a veil that we have to sometimes reflect and remove to expose what's really going on, which is a sense of emptiness. We've lost that groundedness. And many thinkers have spoken about this, even the likes of the psychoanalyst Eric Fromm, when he makes a subtle distinction between the way of having and the way of being. You also have the Korean-born German philosopher Byung Han Chul. He talks about this in his Agony of Eros and many other books, a phenomenal writer and philosopher. And he talks about, because of this individualism, because of this narcissism, we have become narcissistic collectively. And he even argues we don't know how to love anymore. We don't even know how to love anymore. Why? Because in order to love, you need to understand that there is an other than you. But because we're narcissistic, we project ourselves onto the beloved and we just end up loving ourselves. And this is why I'm so touched, moved, and inspired by Medology. In actual fact, just to be very authentic with you, I had to pinch myself on my left calf and my right calf just to stop crying because I get emotional sometimes. I'm actually quite moved that we have young people in the United Kingdom who are willing to take true leadership and to understand that leadership is not only leading from the front. Leadership is not having a title, it's a way of being. As the famous thinker and martial artist Bruce Lee said, to be is to be related. Who are you on a desert island? You know yourself through your relations. You know yourself through your relations, because a way of being is how you relate to yourself and how you relate to others. And that's why in the Islamic tradition, you find yourself through relating to the one who created you. There is no find yourself in the book of God. You have that in self-help. I'm going to find myself, which I think is complete nonsense, because that is basically contingent, dependent on the ideology of the day. In actual fact, if you study social psychology, you're going to change based on social norms and social conventions and the kind of vicissitudes of social expectations, if you like. The point is, in the Islamic tradition, you want to find yourself, you relate to God. And that's why maybe God says, do not be like those who forgot God, and then God made them forget their own selves. As God says, remember me, remember God, I will remember you. So our sense of self is truly found in relating to the one who created us, which is the greatest relationship. Anyway, notwithstanding this, I did put notes together, but I'm on a roll. So leading in a lost world. Now, what do I mean by a lost world? Now, I want to refer to my dear brothers and sisters, who I believe is the greatest man to have walked this planet, and that is the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace. Michael Hart, he's a historian, he wrote the book, The 100, a ranking of the most influential persons in history. He actually said that the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, was the first, number one. Now, many of you may be Muslim, may be skeptical, you may be sitting on the fence, you may be in the fence, you may be on the fence, you may even think the fence doesn't exist. That's irrelevant. I just want you not to believe in what I'm saying. Beliefs are not really important at this stage. I just want you to stand in the possibility that what I'm saying may have value. You don't have to believe in it. You don't have to put your flag down. Just stand in the possibility that some of the principles that I'm going to articulate, some of the things that I'm saying may be working, they may work, and they may be universal, and there may be some truth in them. I'm not telling you, believe in this. I'm telling you, let's stand. Let's stand in a space. And that space is, it's possibly true. It may possibly work. If you stand in that space, I think we're all going to learn from each other, God willing. So, what do I mean by a lost world? Now, let's try and answer this question by reflecting on a prophetic tradition of the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace. And I need to listen very carefully, because every time I reflect on this tradition, it really gets me. The Prophet said, upon whom be peace, two hungry wolves roaming freely among a flock of sheep are less destructive to them than the greed of a man for wealth and high status are to his religion. So in essence, the excessive greed for status and wealth is more damaging to one's faith than two free roaming wolves among sheep. If you know anything about sheep and wolves, if you have two free roaming wolves among sheep, it's a massacre. So what do we learn from this? The first thing we learn is, where is the shepherd? Where's the protector? Where's the guide? Where's the nourisher? Where is the shepherd in this discourse? Number one. Number two, what we learn is this, that our faith, and by extension our humanity, and why am I saying humanity? Because in the Islamic spiritual tradition, we believe every single human being that was born, if you're a child, you're a baby, you're born in a state of a fitra. In the Islamic tradition, fitra means the normative innate disposition, the natural disposition. So an inclination towards the truth, an inclination towards loving God and worshipping Him and affirming His oneness is part of who we are. And that's why we argue when you find Islam, which means submission to God, right? You actually reveal and find your true self because it's already been part of you. We believe in this natural state, as the Quran says in chapter 30, verse 30, adhere to the natural way of God that He has created all human beings. So our faith and by extension our humanity can be severely destroyed by status and wealth. Now, although status and wealth can be used as virtues, as good things, but unfortunately because we give them intrinsic value, they become ends in themselves, they become very destructive. Because for wealth and status to be the antithesis of destruction, to be constructive, to be positive, what do you have to do? You have to use them as instruments, as means to a noble end. But because of this neo-capitalistic, neo-individualistic, neo-liberal culture that we all live in, the primacy of the self, the individual, the ego, the celebration of the ego, right? What happens is that we now give wealth and status intrinsic value. As Eric Fromm talks about, it's a way of having. You define yourself by your possessions. In actual fact, you depend on them. They're like crutches and you walk on them, right? But if you lose those crutches, you're really a cripple, a spiritual and existential cripple. But you need to have a way of being that can use these possessions in a way that is good, that is active. He talks about the active being. The point here is status and wealth, if they're given intrinsic value and their ends are not means, can be destructive, and especially in modernity. And from this perspective, this is all facilitated by the ego, because in many traditions, whether you believe in a secular tradition or a spiritual tradition, there is a universal truth, which is the inner me is the enemy. The inner me is the real enemy. The ego is a barrier to unity. It's a barrier to success. It's a barrier to having a lofty vision. It's a barrier to connecting with other human beings. It's a barrier to relationships. You know, many people rather be right than to be loved, right? I want to be right. I never want to be wrong, right? This kind of egocentric, egotistical attitude. The enemy can be the greatest enemy. And this is why this whole kind of status and wealth and giving it intrinsic value facilitates the ego. So what is the ego? I want to be right. I never want to be wrong. I want to look good. I never want to look bad. I always want to impose. I don't want to impose upon, to the degree that I give up the truth and the right way of being. Which echoes a prophetic tradition where the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, said that kibr, arrogance, is rejecting the truth and thinking you're better than others. So from this perspective, modernity giving the excessiveness to wealth and status and giving intrinsic value, and this, you know, exacerbating the ego based on this kind of modernity paradigm, we've lost our way. We have lost our way. And this is why we need to have the shepherd. Remember we spoke about the two free-roaming wolves among sheep? We need to have the shepherd. We need to have the shepherd leader. We need to have leadership. And one way of dealing with the ego, dealing with the excessive greed for wealth and status and all of these things, is to have constructive and love service leadership, which I believe was the leadership style of the Prophet Muhammad, upon who be peace. Now, before I get into that and discuss another prophetic insight concerning leadership and being a shepherd, I think it's important just to focus a little bit on the whole idea that when we treat status and wealth as ends and not as means, so we don't treat them as a means for greater good, we end up infecting ourselves with the perennial, timeless spiritual diseases. In the Islamic tradition, the four key spiritual diseases, or if you're not spiritually inclined, the psychological diseases are what? Number one, arrogance. Number two, ostentation, showing off. Number three, blameworthy jealousy. I want what he wants, I want what she wants, and I don't want them to have it. And number four, self-amazement. You think you are the cause for everything. You don't understand that the very fact that you are successful, or the very fact that you have any position or ability in life, is because of almost an infinite number of variables outside of your control. And now you think you were catapulted out of your mother's womb with a briefcase and a tie. This is self-amazement. It's all me. I did it. I became a CEO because it's me. I wrote a book because it's me. Total and utter nonsense. Even if you study your own biology, the biological mechanisms, your own mind, your own consciousness, what is happening within your own heartbeat, even the neurocardiology, the 40,000 neurons that you're not even controlling in your own heart that communicate with the brain and sometimes even ignore the brain, when you study your biology, you know you're not in control. You are simply not in control. It's an illusion. Yes, we have some part to play. But the very fact that you're here, that you lived in the UK, that you had lived in the Western world, that you had the money and the ability, the education system, you had the nurses, the doctors, the engineers, you had the road, you had the system, you had all of these things in place, you were utterly dependent on those things. Just think about when you were born, my dear brothers, sisters, and friends. You couldn't feed yourself. You couldn't even wipe your own posterior. You leave a child, a baby, in the corner of a room for even 2 weeks and don't touch it, it will die. And now you think you have this individualism, this neoliberal me, myself, and I. It's all about me, the primacy of the self. I am king. Complete nonsense, delusion. absolute delusion. We are dependent on other people. We can't have this self-amazement. Any of my successes is because of external factors. And all of those external factors, according to the Islamic tradition, are dependent utterly on As-Samad, the absolutely independent God himself. So these are spiritual diseases which are facilitated by giving wealth and status intrinsic value. And they shape our way of being. And your way of being is how you relate to the world. And it makes us become lost spiritually, lost philosophically, and we don't know how to lead properly. We become lost sheep. But we all can become shepherds. We can all save the sheep from the two free roaming wolves. We can save them by taking responsibility. The Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, said, "Every one of you is a shepherd and is responsible for his flock. The leader of people is a guardian and is responsible for his subjects. A man is the guardian of his family and he's responsible for them. A woman is the guardian of her husband's home and his children, and she is responsible for them. The servant of a man is a guardian of the property of his master, and he is responsible for it." No doubt, every one of you is a shepherd and is responsible for his flock. Every single one of us is a leader. You do not need a title. It's a way of being. If you're responsible over anything, including yourself, you have a leader. And interestingly, in this prophetic tradition, the Arabic words that are used are kullukum ra'in. Kullukum ra'in. Everyone is a leader, a shepherd. And interestingly, the Arabic root, if you like linguistics, if you're not linguistically inclined, you could ignore it for a few moments. But the Arabic root for the word shepherd comes from ra'ayn ya. And it has the following meanings: shepherd, to guard, to watch over, to observe, to be a guardian, to manage, to abide, to heed advice, and to mend one's ways. And this is used in the Quranic discourse. In the book of God, chapter 57, verse 27, chapter 23, and verse 8. So let's go now to a shepherd. Right, so everyone is a shepherd. Everyone has responsibility. So let's focus on what are the key aspects of a shepherd. I think there are six. Number one, the shepherd guides. Number two, the shepherd protects. Number three, the shepherd unites. Number four, the shepherd nurtures and nourishes. Number five, the shepherd serves. Number six, the shepherd leads. Before we unpack these aspects, it's very important that underlying these aspects of being a true leader, of being a true shepherd, is number one, having loving mercy for people, having loving mercy for your flock, being committed to the well-being of your flock, being committed to the well-being of your people. This is what love means. Love means that you're committed to the other with their own individuality. You want the optimal version of that person sincerely. You don't have any skin in the game. You're not using them as an instrument, as a means to an end. You are valuing them intrinsically. And by the way, let's just be honest, many of our friendships are not true loving friendships. We just use people. You know, he may be handsome, so I'm likely to get a beautiful girl. She may be rich, so I'm likely to get expensive dinners and expensive holidays. And he's got, like, God knows how many likes and shares on his YouTube channel, Mr. Wilf. May God bless him. You know, we use people as instruments. We don't give them intrinsic value because we become very capitalistic when it comes to our friendships. But in leadership, you can't be like that. You have to know, as the Prophet Muhammad taught us, upon whom be peace, and the Quran, that human beings have this intrinsic value. Allah says he's given dignity to the son of Adam, to human beings. We've been dignified. We have this fitrah, this innate disposition, with this potential to reveal the truth within. And we have to acknowledge that, and we have to understand that if you want to truly be someone who is loving, then you have to be committed to the goodness and guidance of all people. The Prophet Muhammad, upon him be peace, said in a narration that is narrated by Bukhari in Tariq al-Kabir, "Love for people what you love for yourself." The Arabic is linnas, for the people. Love for the people what you love for yourself. Allah, God Himself, describes the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, as a loving mercy to the world, to humanity. He's a rahmah. Rahmah doesn't mean mercy, it means loving mercy. Because rahamim, the root word which also connects to the idea of the womb. The mother loves the baby before the baby's even born. And you remember the prophetic tradition, the Prophet ﷺ said, upon him be peace, that God has more arham, more loving mercy for you than a mother has for her child. So we have to have this loving mercy. You have to be committed to people's well-being. Even if it means that sacrifices, you have to be committed to this identity if you want to be a true leader. I am committed to your well-being. And wallahi, by God, if you connect to people in this way, there'll be hardly any ego. You'll have great relationships. You'll have great leadership. They'll know that you have their back. There's no hidden agenda. You'll be an authentic human being, meaning you don't have any undeclared negative intentions. Because I already declared to my people, as a shepherd, as a leader, I'm not gaining anything from this. I am from the divine, because I'm doing it for His sake. But I am committed to your well-being, even if it means I have to take 1,000 bullets. That's leadership. That is being a true shepherd. So that's one very important thing that we have to have. The second thing we have to understand, that there is no room for the ego. There's no room for, I want to be right, I never want to be wrong, I want to look good, I never want to look bad, I never want to impose upon, to the degree that you give up the right way of being, to the degree that you reject the truth. Because remember, leadership is, you have to have a goal. You have to have a vision, a noble, lofty goal that you can't achieve on your own. You need people around you. The ego becomes a barrier to the essential relationships to facilitate that goal. The ego becomes a barrier to the goal itself. The ego becomes a barrier to good leadership. And that's why, you know, many thinkers, and there's one scholar, his name is Sheikh Yawar Beg, he wrote about prophetic leadership. He said, for the leader, it is essential to always keep the goal in sight and be willing to make everything, especially his own ego, subservient to the accomplishment of the goal. So, let's unpack being a shepherd. The first one was, who remembers? Guide. He guides. How does he guide? How does she guide? That you have a noble, godly goal. You see into the future. You see the world in a particular way that is noble and connected to godly pleasure, to the divine pleasure. It's a noble goal. In other words, it's God-centric. And that makes it meaningful and moral. And what a leader does, he guides them towards that goal. And he guides them through principles of success, principles of righteousness, which we're going to unpack. Number two, the shepherd protects. How does the shepherd protect? How does a leader protect? A leader protects by implementing and identifying the key principles, which we're going to discuss, to ensure that there is an ethical, open, caring, hard-working environment with people of integrity. And you protect the flock from your own ego and other people's egos, which we just discussed. And you focus on the noble vision, achieving it, and the people's well-being, because you cannot achieve this on your own. And in order to protect, you have to have courage. You have to take risks. And the way to help you develop courage and risks, you have to focus not on the action, but on your way of being. Because how you become is the way you're going to overcome. The way you relate to yourself with others is going to be extremely helpful to do the necessary actions to overcome any fear and trials and tribulations. Don't just focus on the action. Number two, focus on your leadership identity. Why are you leading in the first place? It's for that noble goal. It's to protect people, to take them onto that journey, to uplift them, to unveil their blind spots, to ensure that they become optimal versions of themselves, that they work collectively to achieve that noble goal. And I know as a leader, I have to be courageous. So identify with the fact that you have to be courageous. And then once you identify that way, it will naturally happen. The other thing to understand is read about courage. Read about stories of intellectual or physical or leadership type of bravery. Because that would inspire within you similar things. Because if a human being can bench press 100 kilos and they have two arms and two legs and you have two arms and two legs, you're like, well, if they could do it, I could do it too. Also, be around courageous people. And this is a very important principle because states of being give rise to states of being. If you're people who are passionate, if you're around passionate people, you're likely to be passionate. If you're with loving people, you're likely to be loving. If you're with people with certainty, you're likely to have certainty. If you're people who are caring, you're likely to be caring. If you're with people who are brave, you're likely to be brave. And understand what is this. What are the consequences of succumbing to your fears or to these obstacles? Because the pain of not doing anything, of not being courageous in the long term is usually more than the pain of being courageous. So do it anyway. The third point, the shepherd unites the flock, right? Similarly, leaders unite. We cannot achieve things on our own. I mentioned this in the beginning. Your success, my success, is not really truly my success or your success. Technically, it's our success. Because the very fact that you could be a doctor or an engineer or a businessman is that there were like almost an infinite number of variables that you had to be dependent upon in order for you to achieve what you achieved. Now, it makes even more sense if you're part of a team that's trying to achieve a noble, lofty goal. You have to unite and come together. So leaders must create a culture of internal and external unity. What does internal unity mean? Internal unity means the team and the entire organization. External unity means that you realize that the noble vision is bigger than the organization. And the organization is bigger than the individual. Sometimes we make a mistake that we think that our vision is the same as the organization. No. That may mean that your vision is very small, but if it's a big, lofty vision, like you see a world that people have well-being, which is really the short translation of Modology's vision. I see a world that people have well-being. You think Modology can do it themselves? Of course not. So if you're sincere to this noble, God-centric goal, you would work with other people. You'd have that external unity. And that's why vision supremacy leads to external unity, and it leads to actually facilitating and achieving the vision. Number four, the shepherd nurtures and nourishes. We need to nurture and nourish our flock as well. How? The emotional, psychological, and physical well-being should be your concern. You have to help them achieve this well-being by what? By mentoring them. And this is a very important leadership principle. How do you mentor people so they could achieve well-being? Number one, you have to be sincere to them. Number two, you have to believe that there is an optimal version of that person. And that's a fact, because look at you today and look at you 10 years ago. Big difference. There are things that you could achieve now that you couldn't achieve 10 years ago. Proof is, and by protraction, everyone is very similar. So they have great potential. Number three, you want to love them from the perspective that you want them to achieve the optimal version of themselves. And the way to do that is to relate to them, to create from them. How you relate is what you create. How you relate is what you create. If I don't know this brother from Adam, but if I meet this brother and I'm sincere to him as a human being and I believe he has this amazing potential and I'm seeking ways for him to achieve that potential and I'm acting verbally and through my body language in such a way so he does achieve that potential, even through our interaction, you're going to get the best version of him. And this is the methodology of the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace. Fudala ibn Umar was someone who nominally became a Muslim, nominally became a submitted to the divine. He was circumambulating the Kaaba. And he wanted to kill the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace. And the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, asked him, what are you saying to yourself? And he kind of pretending that he was doing some remembrance. And the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, used his language and his body language. He put his hand on his heart and he said to him, ask God to forgive you. And once he removed his hand, Fudala ibn Umar said, after that moment, no one was more beloved to me than the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace. We have so many narrations concerning how you relate is what you create. This is the concept in Islam called hilm, forbearance. As the Quran says in chapter 41, verse 34, Good and evil are not the same. Good and evil are not equal. Repel by that which is better. And between two people there is enmity, it will turn to intimate friendship. Beautiful verse. The scholars say that this means repel anything by what is more virtuous and what is more beautiful. Number five, the shepherd serves, the leader serves. And I believe we must have love, service, leadership. The Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, said, God will be at the assistant of his servant so long as such a person is at the assistance of his brother. There is another prophetic tradition collected by Shah Wali Allah Ad-Dahlawi. He said, the leader of a people is the servant. So if the goal is noble, and to achieve that vision, you have to have people who must become optimal versions of themselves to achieve that vision, then you must be at service to them. Your energy, your time, your focus, your dedication, your love, your compassion, your mentoring. You must serve that to them sincerely in order for them to achieve that potential. Number six. The shepherd leads. Now what's very interesting, when you look at a shepherd, sometimes he's in the middle of the flock, sometimes he's behind the flock, sometimes he's sitting on the mountain just watching by and leaning on his shepherd stick, sometimes he's at the back, and that's what leadership is. Don't think leadership is, I'm always on camera, I'm always in the front, I'm always the one to lead. No, the greatest leadership sometimes is leading from the behind. Great leaders create other leaders. Great leaders create other leaders, my dear brothers and sisters and friends. Sometimes we have to lead from the behind, lead from the middle, lead from the front. Sometimes we have to go away from the flock to get those who have moved away and bring them back. That's dedication. That's leadership. Leadership is not a title, it's a way of being. And if you have no ego and you have subjugated your ego for that noble, godly, lofty goal, then you know sometimes you have to lead from the back, lead from the middle. Sometimes you have to do work that is work that you ordinarily will hate because you are God-centric. You're connected to the bigger vision. You've subjugated your ego. You've submitted your ego to this good, lofty, God-pleasing goal that is moral and noble. So from this perspective, if we want to lead as well, we have to have integrity. What does integrity basically mean? What you say is what you do. You keep your word. You are your word. When you say table, table falls out of your mouth. What you say is what you do. And your word becomes your identity because you know no one can read your heart, but they could see what you say and you do. So you identify with that, not just with your feelings. You are trustworthy and you're sincere. And what you do as well is that you don't enroll, you control. You don't control, you enroll. You enroll people in your behavior. You be that which you want others to become. How many leaders want their people to be so great, but they're not great themselves? How many leaders want their people to be moral, but they're not moral themselves? Be that which you want other people to become. Don't control, enroll. Enroll. Don't control. Enroll people in your behavior. Like the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, his companions were a bit reluctant to shave their heads after the minor pilgrimage. And he went to his wife for consultation, Salama. And he asked her and he told her what the situation was. And what did she say? Shave your head first. Once he shaved his head, they all followed. You need to be an embodiment of your vision. You need to be an embodiment of what you want others to become. It's tough work. And that was the sixth point, and I just want to end on this. You all could follow these principles in every aspect of your life. You're all shepherds, as the Prophet said, upon whom be peace. And let me just warn you. Leadership is painful. In actual fact, there's something called leadership pain. If you're not in pain, you're not in leadership. And you may say, I don't want to be in pain. Life is full of pain. Choose your poison. If you're in love, you're going to be in pain. If you're not in love, you're going to be in pain. If you're eating, you may be in pain. If you're not eating, you're going to be in pain. And life is full of pain. Embrace it. To reject pain in this kind of, you know, cotton wool society that we have is self-defeating, because your mom bore you through pain. Imagine you said, I'm not going to have pain. Let me just cut him out, right? No, pain is necessary because it facilitates growth. It facilitates success. It's a sign for success. You want to get big muscles? You have to be in pain. You want to be a good martial artist? You got to be in pain. You want to be a doctor? You're going to have pain. Physical, existential, psychological. Yeah, right? You're going to be... Pain is necessary. Embrace it. So if you're going to adopt this role of being a shepherd for whoever you're responsible for, embrace the pain. And the pain is going to happen because you, if you're dedicated to people's well-being, you want people to be optimal versions for themselves. You want to achieve this vision. You have this kind of positive anxiety about achieving that noble, God-centric goal. You're going to be in a state of pain. And the way to deal with that pain is, yes, sometimes to take a rest. Ask for help. Have good inner circle. Have people who love and respect you genuinely, that will take 1,000 bullets for you. Have that 3 a.m. friend, which many of you don't have, by the way, unfortunately. There was a study, around 50% of people, 60% or something like that, don't have that 3 a.m. person, because we use each other as instruments. We don't give them intrinsic value. Build a good network. Have loving relationships, true loving relationships, because true love is to be dedicated to the spiritual growth of human beings. This is something that M. Scott Peck wrote. This is something that Eric Fromm talks about. This is something that Al-Ghazali, the 11th century polymath, proof of Islam, scholar of Islam, he wrote something similar. And in actual fact, I'll end on this. If we truly have self-love, we have to love other people. We have to be dedicated to the well-being of other people. Because the closest thing to you is you. Self-love is like a form of self-empathy. It's not narcissism. That's delusional. Self-love is, I want good for myself. I'm going to be disciplined to be committed to my spiritual well-being. If you don't have that discipline, if you don't have that true self-love, how can you love anybody else? And Al-Ghazali talks about this self-love. And he also concludes that if you really have self-love, then you must love God. Because he says, who is the one who created the physical causes in the universe that you use in order to have well-being? Who's the one who guided you to an optimal way of life? God himself. Who's the one who showed you what is good? Who is the basis for good and bad? That's where you have to love the divine. If you truly love yourself, you have to love God and you have to love others. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.